From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. War and peace, education, taxes, the environment, they're all part of the big picture. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet the man who gives the big picture on Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update, political comedian A. Whitney Brown. Also today, we talk with Richard Marriott, the leader of the Clubfoot Orchestra. Marriott has written new music to accompany the classic silent films Nosferatu, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and Metropolis. Rock historian Ed Ward goes back to soul music of the 70s, and book critic John Leonard reviews the debut novel from Argentinian writer Alberto Manguel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In Baghdad, the Kurdish rebel leader Jalal Talabani says he's reached agreement in principle with Saddam Hussein on the subject of Kurdish autonomy. The Kurdish leader told a news conference that Saddam is promising democracy, press freedom, and guarantees that all Kurds can return safely to their homes. He said they need further negotiations to work out the details. Mike Theodoulou reports from Nicosia.
Agreement was reached after 5 days of talks in Baghdad, which the Iraqi media kept secret till today. Talabani said it was based on a 1970 deal giving Iraq's 3.5 million Kurds autonomy. The final agreement would be signed along with Masoud Barzani, the Kurds' other main leader, he said. These developments come as American and British forces in northern Iraq are finding it hard coaxing Kurdish refugees down out of the mountains because they're so terrified of Saddam's troops. A month ago, Talabani was leading a revolt against Saddam, who in turn crushed it with such brutality that more than 1 million Kurds fled their homes. Tonight, the two leaders were seen on Iraqi television hugging and kissing. Kurdish leaders say it would have been irresponsible not to talk to Saddam at a time when Kurdish babies are dying in refugee camps. There have been similar agreements in the past. All have failed. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodoulou in Nicosia.
Digging out continues in Costa Rica following Monday's killer earthquake. And as the dead are counted, concern is mounting for the health of the living. Today, Costa Ricans' nerves were further shattered by a strong aftershock. Tony Avergan has more.
Normally, here in earthquake-prone Costa Rica, a small quake like today's would have gone unnoticed. But following Monday's killer quake, it was enough to drive a nervous population to the streets. There were no reports of further damage. More than 15,000 people were left homeless in the Costa Rican and Panamanian Caribbean coastal region by Monday's earthquake. That quake destroyed water and sewage systems and cut electrical lines. And with so many people living in makeshift shelters with no clean water and no sewage systems, health officials say the area is susceptible to major health problems, including cholera, which is moving north from an outbreak in Peru. Efforts to deliver food, water, and medicines are severely hampered by the fact that every road and bridge in the Caribbean zone was destroyed by the quake. Unless something changes very soon, officials fear the race against disease will be lost. For National Public Radio, this is Tony Avergan in San Jose, Costa Rica.
Stock prices were up today on Wall Street. Analysts said that traders were still cautious as the Federal Reserve gave no indication whether or not it will act to reduce interest rates again. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 19 points to close at 2,949.5. Advances led declines in active trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 167 million shares. This is NPR News. Lawyers in Kuwait are demanding access to the hundreds of people who've been imprisoned without trial since the end of the Gulf War. The leader of a Kuwaiti lawyers organization said today that about 800 people are believed to be in custody. He said that most of the detainees were held by the police or intelligence services and not under the control of government prosecutors. The lawyers group said that people have been held for 2 months and lawyers haven't been allowed to talk with them or to attend police interrogations. A court has not yet been formed to try them. President Bush said today that he'll order a review of the White House travel policy amid reports that his chief of staff, John Sununu, frequently used U.S. military planes for his political and personal travel. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Records released yesterday by Governor Sununu show that he used Air Force jets to visit his Boston dentist and to take ski trips. In each case, the government was reimbursed according to policy, but at a rate far short of the real cost of the flights. Today, the president praised Sununu for having disclosed his travel records and said he didn't think there was any abuse.
But I think it is appropriate to take another look at the policy because I want our administration to be above even the perception of impropriety.
Sununu's records show that he used military planes more than 70 times since 1989. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
One of Yugoslavia's breakaway republics has softened its stand on secession. Slovenian President Milan Kucan said today that he favors a gradual and nonviolent split with the Balkan Federation. In December, Slovenian voters approved a referendum calling for the republic to break away from Yugoslavia by June. The neighboring Republic of Croatia has said it would join Slovenia if it secedes. The nationalist leaders of both regions have been at odds with the communist leaders of other Yugoslav republics. Western nations have reportedly told Slovenia's leaders that Yugoslavia must avoid civil war. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Here to give us the big picture is A. Whitney Brown. Brown delivers his political commentaries, called The Big Picture, on Weekend Update, Saturday Night Live's cynical comic twist on the news. He's been delivering his commentaries on Saturday Night Live for the past 5 years. They're collected in his new book, The Big Picture. I asked A. Whitney Brown to read his commentary, The Education President.
Friends, we live in a nation of 25 million illiterates. I read that in USA Today. Well, I didn't actually read it, but there was a chart with a stick figure with a diploma hat on pointing to a pie with black and blue and black pieces missing out of it. But that's a scary thought. 1 out of 10 adult Americans can't even read USA Today. What are they all going to do in life? Well, they can't all write for it. Maybe they can dictate the editorials. Maybe they can color in the weather map on the back. You see, other countries, they have programs. Japan, the few illiterate individuals are put to work translating VCR instructions into English. But here, opportunities are limited. Now, I like to read, but I'm not one to push my preferences on others. Rather than campaign fruitlessly against the evils of illiteracy, I got a job writing for television. You know, this spring, I found myself sitting in a restaurant watching a party of young people celebrating. I soon realized they were members of the New York City high school graduating class of 1990, part of that elite 48% of New Yorkers that made it all the way through the system. They were celebrating their unbounded future by dining at Denny's, a restaurant chosen for its use of pictures on the menu. And as I watched them pointing to their selections and puzzling over the arithmetic in a futile attempt to calculate who owed what for the patty melt, it struck me that far too many will face the future ill-equipped to tackle the intricacies of TV guide in this age of cable. It was their bad luck to go through school before the education president was elected. But you see, it's all a matter of priorities. If they didn't get much out of our shabby, run-down, under-financed old school system, maybe they'll do a little bit better in our brand-new billion-dollar prison program. Either way, I'm sure the education president is concerned about every illiterate one of them. Not as concerned as he'd be if they had an abortion or burned the flag, but he cares.
That's A. Whitney Brown reading from his new book, The Big Picture, and welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, it's nice to be here, Tracy.
Terry.
I mean, Terry.
Yeah, but we're old pals.
Yeah.
That no one in the audience should be fooled by that little slip.
Yeah, all right. Well, Terry, if that is your real name.
How did you feel about translating the things that you do on Saturday Night Live into a book?
I felt the greatest feeling of freedom that I've had since for quite a while. It's wonderful to be able to take more than 89 seconds to explain your point of view.
Do you find doing political comedy that there's a problem with audiences who don't follow the newspapers and don't necessarily know what you're talking about?
I find that a lot of people are actively screen out current events. I remember one time, this was a few years ago, I was talking about the ABM treaty, and The information that ABM stands for anti-ballistic missile and that we have a treaty preventing the development of those has been given to every single American probably 100 times since Kennedy signed that treaty. And for someone not to know it, they have to be actively screening it out. And so it's a matter of interest. They screen it out like they do commercials because they don't think they can understand it. So what I try to do is give people the information that they need to understand the joke in the preceding joke. And on top of making them able to laugh at it, since they're not really aware they're getting that information or being reminded of it, it also makes them feel very intelligent when they suddenly understand the joke. And that's a good way to make friends.
Let me ask you to update the reading that you did for us. Do you have any impressions on George Bush's recently unveiled education policy?
Well, I think it's inevitable now. What he did, you know, after I think it springs directly from the war in Iraq, because we realized that we won the war because we have the smartest bombs in the world. Unfortunately, our bombs are smarter than our average high school graduates. At least the bombs can find Kuwait. You know, and of course, I think after the war they realized they've reached the limit of that technology, because it stands to reason if they make the bombs any smarter, they're going to have second thoughts about war itself. And then you'll be right back where you started from, having to fight with soldiers.
Hmm.
So, you know, he's finally getting around to being the education president, but I just can't figure out what was keeping him from being the education vice president for 8 years. It's not like he would have been stepping on any toes during that era. You know, not to imply that the reason the bombs are so smart is because they got all the education money. But, well, he did teach Saddam Hussein a lesson, I suppose.
I want to talk a little bit about your background now. I was reading a little bit about you, and apparently when you were 14, your father put you into a juvenile home. What was he worried about? What did you do?
He wanted to be alone with his new wife.
Oh, is that it?
Basically, yeah.
So what was the home like?
It was nice. It was really nice. It was wonderful. It was like a military school. It was very humane, actually. You know, I mean, we had to work in coal mines for 18 hours a day, but other than that, no, it was nice. We had our own room, you know, 3 meals a day. It was nicer than my own home, actually.
So it wasn't the kind of place where to straighten you out, you really ended up learning more about crime and delinquency?
That happened to most of the kids there, yeah.
And you?
Not to me, no. I was very fortunate enough to run into two people there who saw something in me that they thought might reward their efforts. And I dedicated the book to them, as a matter of fact, those two teachers. So I was very lucky.
When you got out of the home, you didn't go back to school. You went to Canada.
Yeah, right. I just wanted to get out of the country. And also, when I got there, I found out that if you were a draft dodger, they give you free food. And even though I was only 16, I just told them I was a draft dodger. So I was posing as a coward. That's about as low as you can get, I suppose.
Well, do you think draft dodgers were cowards? Is that what you're
saying? At the time, I did, yeah.
Was that an interesting political experience for you to be exposed to people who really were draft dodgers and who had given a lot of thought to the reasons why they were against the war and had, you know, uprooted themselves because of their conviction?
Well, I don't think it was because of conviction in most cases. It was because they didn't want to go into the army. But yes, I'll tell you, the people who were helping them were very committed. And really believed in what they were doing. And, of course, that's bound to have an impact on you.
So you ended up going from Canada to San Francisco. Where did you have your political awakening? Do you think of yourself as having had one?
No, I really don't. I don't really think I have an axe to grind.
Mm-hmm.
I just like to make people laugh, and if I can, to look at things with a slightly different perspective than they did before. I'm not attached to any particular perspective. And I'm always ready to change. I don't have any opinions about anything that I wouldn't change. You know, most people think war is probably the worst thing in the world. I don't know. Maybe, you know, there's things worse than that. I was trying to figure out the other day what I am against, truly, under all circumstances. One thing that I really am against. And torture, I guess, is about all. I mean, even murder sometimes is justified. And, you know, war, I mean, hopeless poverty, I think that's worse than war. I mean, I think if your, you know, country was hopelessly in poverty and with no hope of getting out, then that'd be worth fighting a war over.
How did you end up doing political comedy? Had you tried other forms of comedy?
Yeah, and I was very successful. I still do other forms of comedy. You know, it's interesting because I never wanted to do political comedy because I didn't think it was long-lasting. I wanted to develop comedy. I wanted my work to still be able to be read in a few years, you know. But when I was watching The Tonight Show, it was in 1980, after the Russians had invaded Afghanistan, and Johnny Carson, who I really admire as a comedian, but he was doing this joke about it, and the punchline of the joke was he turned around and he dropped his pants, and on the back of his boxer shorts was written, "Russia sucks." And I was embarrassed for my country that this would be the level of humor in politics, political humor. I was embarrassed. I was ashamed. I was afraid that a person from another country might see that and think that all Americans, that that's all that they had to say. And so I resolved to try and write something and give them an alternative, you know. And I did, and 6 months later, I did it on The Tonight Show.
Do you ever have to deal with censors on Saturday Night Live?
Not anymore.
When did that end?
Oh, a year or so ago when the show started getting really scatological. Yeah, that's how we take it out. I never have had to deal with censors. And although I say things that if it were done in a sketch, the censors would have objected to it. But because I'm presenting it as my point of view, you have more latitude. You know, it's presented as separate from the show as my point of view. And so, but if they're doing it in a sketch, it's like we're endorsing that point of view.
So no one's ever told you even that you were going too far in your opinion on a political leader or president?
As a matter of fact, I did a commentary once and I got a number of letters as well as midnight phone calls about it. And NBC, since I was gone, I was out of town, where I left town shortly thereafter, they wrote a letter and sent it to the people who wrote. And it couldn't have been written better if I had written it myself, you know, pointing out what it was really about and sticking up for me, you know, backing me up. It was about the Intifada. And some people interpreted it as being anti-Semitic when, in fact, it was anti-violence. Or, you know, they were breaking people's hands, remember that?
Mm-hmm.
For throwing rocks. And that cripples somebody for life. Can't type, can't play a musical instrument. And they bulldoze a house, you know, if they caught somebody in the house. So anyway, I was saying if they want to make an example out of these people, maybe they should try crucifixion. Because it worked for the Romans. And they thought I was saying that, you know, the Jews crucified Christ. Which I didn't. I said it worked for the Romans, you know. It was a sarcastic statement. So anyway, NBC backed me up and said, you know, that was all right. Now if they would just help me write the sketches.
Yeah. Can I get you to read another section from your new book?
I don't know. Yeah, sure, I'd love to.
Let's see, how about page 42?
I'm glad you picked this. All right, because this sums up my generation. Thank you very much. Well, as for me, I discovered acid in the summer of 68 and subsequently took enough to do chromosome damage to a Buick. For most of the winter of 68 and 69, I stumbled through a psychedelic blizzard. I became a shiftless teenage derelict, hitchhiking from dead concert to dead concert, trying to see through my hair. Through the white haze, I could make out a strange roaring sound. I was told later it was the babble of that great deaf-mute of history, the silent majority, articulating its choice for president, Richard Milhouse Nixon. Most of my generation didn't have a clue what was going on. In fact, we greeted each other with the very question, "What's going on, man?" We didn't say, "Nice to see you," or "How have you been?" like people do when they have a value system that isn't crumbling in front of their eyes. No, no, we wanted to know, "What's happening, man? What's the deal, dude? What's the buzz?" Nobody knew. The only answer I ever got was, "What it is." What it was, none of us knew. By the end of the decade, I was beginning to think the question was purely rhetorical. Well, the search for meaning came naturally to me. I grew up in a generation so starved for understanding we were able to read significance into Donovan lyrics.
So what got you to write about your teenage years and, quote, your generation?
I think the statement, you know, that we didn't know what was going on. It struck me once, but that's what we used to say, what's going on? And it had to mean something more than just, you know, a greeting. Why would we greet? No one else in history has ever greeted each other by going, I'm confused. And so I wanted to try and figure it out. Didn't, though, but I did realize that we were confused.
A. Whitney Brown gives the big picture on Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update. His commentaries are collected in the new book, The Big Picture. Coming up, Ed Ward on Soul Hits of the 70s. This is Fresh Air. A lot of the soul music we hear these days is on commercials and baby boomer movie soundtracks. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a review of a new collection of soul hits he says you might enjoy on its own.
I spent the 80s being proud of myself for quipping that the 70s were, as I termed it, the nostalgia-proof decade. Now it appears I've been proven wrong by Rhino Records. Last year, they put out 10 volumes of the decade's pop hits, a set that only covered the first third of the 70s, and elicited critical responses ranging from bemused approval to outright horror. I'll admit it, after playing Volume 1 one afternoon, I never opened any of the others. Then, about a month ago, Rhino started releasing another 10-volume series of 70s soul hits. This time, I paid attention. I remember 70s soul well. Until punk came along, it was very nearly all I really enjoyed, at least all that was played on the radio that I enjoyed. If it hadn't been for soul, and to a lesser extent country music, I think I would have died of boredom during the 70s. And yet, I found myself thinking, wasn't the soul scene under the same pressure as the rock scene? Didn't the same thing that made the Rhino's 70s pop collection so awful, namely the growing corporatization of the record business and the radio business, encroach on soul? Or had I misremembered things? The answer, of course, was right on the records.
I gave my heart and soul to you, girl. Didn't I do it, baby? Didn't I do it, baby? I gave you a love you never knew, girl. Oh, didn't I do it, baby? Didn't I do it?
Even a complex, lush record like the Delphonics' Didn't I Blow Your Mind This Time came out on a relatively small label, Philly Groove, although it had a lot of the hallmarks of later major label records, including named producers, songwriters, and arrangers. Sure, the major labels had plenty of soul music, but they tended to buy it from independent producers as a finished product. This meant, for one thing, that those producers took the financial risk, at least until they settled a production deal with the big boys. And it also meant, at least until around 1974, when disco's crossover appeal made people start thinking twice about this stuff, that black pop was perceived as small time, not worth major investment. So, because of that, some very odd things showed up on the charts during this time.
I am W-O-O-O, and I'm still here.
Double Barrel by Dave and Ansel Collins was hardcore reggae, but somebody had the clout to turn it into a hit. With the decline of the fortunes of the 60s big black-owned labels, Stax and Motown, the field was wide open for all manner of records to rush in and make a try.
Ooh, child, things are gonna get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter. Ooh, child, things are gonna get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter.
Together and we'll get it undone someday when you hit it much lighter. Someday.
Despite anomalies like Double Barrel, the majority of these hits were nothing more or less than good old-fashioned soul music, albeit with a healthy dose of influences from the masters, Motown, Stax, and Sly Stone. There was rhythm, there was blues, and of course, usually in the summertime, there were ballads.
I see her face everywhere I go, on the street and even at the picture show. Have you seen her? Tell me, have you seen her? Oh, I hear her voice as the cold winds blow, in the sweet music on the radio. Have you seen her? Tell me, have you seen her?
Although there are 10 volumes in the Rhino series of soul hits, it only goes through the middle of 1973. What this means is that it documents the scene just prior to disco's arrival. Since the series follows the charts pretty scrupulously, this also means that there are some clunkers here to remind us that as good as soul music was, and as bad as the pop charts were, white folks didn't have any monopoly on bad taste. I hope this series continues right through the decade, and that it doesn't shy away from so-called disco music, since the disco years brought with them some of the finest black pop America has ever produced. Forget trying to sell this as nostalgia. A lot of people refused to pay any attention to it the first time around on principle. This is their chance to begin to find out just what a big mistake they made, and to remedy it.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. He reviewed the new Rhino collection of 70s soul hits. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, new music for classic silent films. Richard Marriott is the leader of the Clubfoot Orchestra. The group plays his postmodern scores for silent films he thinks of as eternally avant-garde, films like Nosferatu, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and Metropolis. As an editor, Alberto Manguel was responsible for several collections of dark fantasy. Now he's written his first novel dealing with the dark subject of terrorism. Book critic John Leonard has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Allied forces in the northern Iraqi city of Zaqo have given the Iraqi local police 48 hours to clear out of town. The current American Marines in northern Iraq were bolstered today by the arrival of 600 British Marines. The British Marines arrived by helicopter to take up patrol positions while U.S. troops continued to build camps for thousands of Iraqi refugees. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev warned his critics today that his departure from office would create an explosive power vacuum that could pave the way for a dictatorship. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
Gorbachev was speaking at a closed-door meeting of Communist Party leaders, where some critics had hoped to challenge his position as party chief. That challenge apparently failed, although the party meeting continues tomorrow. In his remarks, Gorbachev acknowledged the numerous demands that he stepped down, both as party chief and as president of the Soviet Union. Coal miners have been on strike for nearly 2 months, calling for Gorbachev's resignation, and his departure from the presidency is now a standard demand for other strikers around the country. Gorbachev answered these demands today by saying he's determined to stay in office. If he goes, said Gorbachev, the democratic institutions he created would be replaced by arbitrary rule, or, said Gorbachev, to put it simply, by a very real dictatorship. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
The Palestine Liberation Organization has formally rejected the idea of a regional peace conference as proposed by Secretary of State James Baker. After 3 days of intensive debate, the PLO's Central Council, meeting in Tunis, has published a final communique insisting on a full international conference. But Peter Hyatt reports from Tunis that this victory for the radicals is balanced by other statements welcoming peace initiatives.
The final statement says the PLO rejects any conference, whether regional or not, which is not based on UN resolutions. Instead, it repeats the PLO's long-standing demand for an international peace conference under the auspices of the UN, with the participation of all parties concerned, including the PLO and the 5 permanent members of the UN Security Council. PLO moderates have expressed disappointment at this. They argue, like Mr. Baker, that the content of any conference is more important than the form it takes. However, moderates did succeed in beating off challenges from radical groups which oppose any further Palestinian contact with Mr. Baker on his current peace initiative. The Council undertook to contribute positively and effectively to peace efforts and reaffirmed its commitment to the PLO's own peace initiative of 1988. For National Public Radio, this is Peter Hyatt in Tunis.
On Wall Street, stocks closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 19 points to close at 2949.51. Advances narrowly edged out declines in active trading of 167 million shares. This is NPR. The Detroit City Council has voted to reject Mayor Coleman Young's request to sell off about 8,500 police guns and then use the proceeds to buy more modern weapons. The money from the sale would have come to about $646,000, but the council president said she thought the guns should be melted down. Council members were worried that the weapons will end up, or rather would end up, in criminals' hands. Detroit Executive Police Chief James Bannon told the city council last week that it was important that officers get more powerful handguns so that they are armed as well as criminals are. The deputy president of the African National Congress, Nelson Mandela, has held talks in London with British Prime Minister John Major. A British spokesman described the meeting as friendly and energetic, but Mandela told a news conference they had differed on several issues. Jonathan Dyer reports from London.
The main objection from Mr. Mandela was to Britain's call for a relaxation of sanctions. The European Community last week ended its ban on the importation of iron, steel and gold Krugerrands. Mr. Mandela said the sanctions were there for a specific purpose.
To give the vote to all the people of South Africa and to scrap apartheid. Neither of these objectives have been achieved. And for that reason, we believe that sanctions should be maintained.
Prime Minister Major urged the ANC not to break off talks with the government on a new constitution, saying this was the best way of ensuring shared goals on ending apartheid and establishing non-racial democracy. The ANC has given the South African government until May 9th to sack the ministers of defence and law and order. For National Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Dyer in London.
The International Monetary Fund says that world economic growth has deteriorated since last fall, but it should start bouncing back. The IMF, in its semi-annual World Economic Outlook, predicts that world economic activity will grow a healthier 3% in 1992. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The Clubfoot Orchestra performs new music for classic silent films. My guest is Richard Marriott, the orchestra's composer. He's written contemporary scores for The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and Nosferatu. The San Francisco-based band has accompanied the films live and is heard on new video versions. They're on tour with those two films, as well as Fritz Lang's Metropolis, the latest film that Marriott has scored. The opening scene of Metropolis throws us into a futuristic city ruled by machines. We see interconnected gears turning at different speeds. Marriott reflects the mechanized movements in the rhythmic complexity of his score for Metropolis. You've chosen to write music for silent films that's very contemporary, and the music you're writing isn't in the manner of the silent film scores. Did you ever have any concern that there would be a clash of period and style?
I've had that concern, and at times I've gone out of my way to try to recreate at least my vision of the music of the 20s. However, I feel that the image itself is kind of an eternally avant-garde image in all of these movies. One that really doesn't date, one that could be made by a student filmmaker of today. And for that reason, I sometimes have found the music that was printed on the movie to be maybe too sentimental or too much looking backwards to Victorian times. And that's why I felt that all of these films could use much more modern music.
Well, does that help explain how you've made your choices of films that you'll write music to? Because you have really chosen films that were very progressive or avant-garde for their period and are very forward-looking visually.
And that's true. That is why I've chosen these particular films. In all cases, I feel that these films were kind of cutting edge in the vision of the director, and the music that was usually written for these movies was inordinately indebted to Wagner or other music of that time, and also associated with the usual manner of having a small orchestra play for a silent movie, and that would be taking popular semi-classical songs and more or less improvising on them. If the woman would be rescued, the young damsel would be rescued, they would launch into Ride of the Valkyries. And if the hero was somewhat of a schmuck, they would play it a little off tune and mix in some bad notes. And so they had a whole repertoire of cues that the audience would recognize. Meanwhile, the audiences have changed. They don't recognize those cues anymore.
I'm wondering if the narrative of the movies that you're scoring leads you to write music that you otherwise might not have written, if it suggests emotions that you otherwise wouldn't have thought about musically. And what I'm thinking is that, you know, irony is the condition of postmodernism.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sometimes difficult removing the quotation marks from the things that postmodern composers write. But when you're scoring for a movie, you
yes.
really have to get into the emotion
yes,
of it.
Yes, and that's perhaps one reason I wanted to do movies so bad, is that it makes you take the quotation marks off what you do. In Caligari, there's a very pretty girl. That's what the movie says. This is a pretty girl. And here's two men who both want her. And putting quotation marks around this is not the intent of the movie, and it also, because of that, it lets us write music that perhaps is genuinely beautiful. But the challenge of this is to keep the edge on it so it doesn't ever become corny. Still have it be palatable. It's a very, very fine edge. But I feel that these movies have allowed me to write music that you wouldn't play in a dance club. You wouldn't even play in a concert stage. It's a whole different genre of music, perhaps, in terms of what's allowable.
Now, let me ask you about Nosferatu. It's such a beautiful, haunting, and death-absorbed movie. Now, there's a scene where, I forget whether it's Mina or Nina, invites the vampire to her room, knowing the only way to destroy him is to keep him at her bedside until dawn breaks.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you to describe what you did musically there. It opens with these really screeching dissonances and goes into something else.
Nina waits for everyone to be asleep. So basically we have a somnambulistic calm in the music. It's extremely dissonant. And this, we add the instruments as if she's drawing the vampire into herself. The instruments join one by one and build this yearning, you know, this vampire who is driven by his lust to her. And then what we encounter is, as it builds and builds, we get into the vampire's mind, this overwhelming lust that is going to lead to his destruction. It's at that point that he loses control, and we go into this burlesque theme, which the audience, I'm sure, subconsciously identifies with being out of control. And so not only does it feel the part of the victim, like almost any other horror movie, but it also feels this overwhelming out-of-controlness that is going to, for certain, make the vampire stay past dawn.
I read that you played your first gig at a burlesque house.
That's true.
Is there a connection there between writing this kind of burlesque music for the vampire and what you used to play?
I'm sure it is. I'm sure the connection really is waking up as a child at night and listening to my father playing Count Basie records late at night. Not that Count Basie should be associated with burlesque, but especially some of his records of the 50s, have this wonderful out-of-control feeling, where the rhythm section, though, is so precise and so perfectly balanced, and these trombones and saxophones on top of that are just totally out of control in a very controlled sort of way. And I'm sure some of this is waking up at night and feeling everything a child feels when they wake up at night and hearing this music.
I'm wondering if you were concerned that by using the burlesque theme for the real climactic moment of the movie, that you might be putting some more quotation marks around the emotion there.
That might be. And I'm sure that some people have felt that. Some people have found that humorous. I don't find that humorous. I find it frightening.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Marriott. He's a composer and musician with the group The Clubfoot Orchestra, and he's composed the scores for three silent movies, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, Nosferatu, and the latest is Fritz Lang's Metropolis. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Composer and musician Richard Marriott is my guest. He's with the Clubfoot Orchestra, and they're touring now performing his silent scores, new silent scores, for the films Nosferatu, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and Metropolis. What was the first impetus behind you writing for a movie?
We had been playing dance clubs and concerts in San Francisco and California, and after seeing us one night, Jim Turner, a fellow who is the founder of the Duck's Breath Mystery Theater and also Randy of the Redwoods on MTV, and a friend of the band, saw us, and he said, "I have a great idea. Why don't you guys write for silent movies or for silent films?" What he meant was taking outtakes of 50s sitcoms or spy shows and found footage and gluing these things together and coming up with offbeat jazz, rock, classical soundtracks, I guess. The next day, though, I was watching television. They had The Evolution of the Horror Movie, and on it was The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. Little clips, enough for me to see the sets, enough for me to see the stylized emotions, but most of all for me to get the feeling of dread. And also, the music just popped into my head, a music that you could use dissonance and it would express something to everyday people. You could use pretty melodies and it would express things to your average person, your average moviegoer. It seemed like an ideal avenue to express many different kinds of music and many different emotions. And you'd be justified in doing it. You didn't have to have a reason for doing it because the film dictates it. The film dictates the reason.
Yeah, I find what you're saying very interesting, because I was thinking, you know, watching one of your films and listening to the music, that this is the kind of music that, if it were in a concert hall or in a performance space, probably wouldn't draw a really big crowd. A lot of people would think of themselves as, well, not liking that kind of music, too dissonant, too avant-garde. But match it with a movie, and I think people would just really fall in with it very quickly in a way that they might not, that they might be negatively predisposed to, you know, in a concert hall, because
exactly,
people have all these preconceptions about what they're going to like and what they're not going to like.
Exactly. And also, what we found out in the dance-slash-concert setting is people would hear this music, and their feet might want to dance, but they wouldn't know how to dance to it. They wouldn't know if they were supposed to dance. And so sometimes some very good dancers would get up and dance to 11/8 time. And most people didn't know what to do. They needed a social context for this experience. The movie provides a great social context for it. And so I've found that very liberating.
Well, Richard Marriott, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you, Terry.
Richard Marriott is composer and trombonist with the Clubfoot Orchestra. He's composed new scores for the silent films The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, Nosferatu, and Metropolis. The orchestra begins an East Coast tour this week in Worcester, Massachusetts, and then travels to Burlington, Hartford, Boston, Providence, Philadelphia, and New York. The Clubfoot Orchestra performing their new score for The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel, host of All Things Considered. Coming up later on today's program, news of a reported agreement between Saddam Hussein's government and one of the leaders of the Iraqi Kurds. The Kurdish leader, Jalal Talabani, says that Baghdad has granted the Kurds autonomy, and the refugees now in the mountains near Turkey and Iran can return to their homes. We'll also hear about Mikhail Gorbachev surviving yet another challenge to his leadership of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. And Tom Manoff tells us about two versions of Rachmaninoff's Vespers and why the Russian version strikes him as having a lot more soul than the newer American one. Those stories coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Alberto Manguel is an Argentinian-born writer, translator, and editor who's worked in the realms of fantasy and horror. Manguel now lives in Canada. His books include The Dictionary of Imaginary Places, a guide to such places as Camelot, Oz, and Lilliput, the Oxford Book of Canadian Ghost Stories, and several short story anthologies. Book critic John Leonard has a review of Manguel's first novel, News from a Foreign Country Came.
People are responsible for their own deaths, says Antoine Barrantes, late in this extraordinary novel. Antoine is a French military officer, retired to the shores of a lake in Quebec, after years of shadowy service in Algeria and Argentina. In his library, stared down on by a copperplate Durer engraving of a knight-errant and the devil, Antoine reads Camus and Céline, quotes Dante, and listens to Brahms. Outside this house of culture, nature runs riot. All the weathers of a violent world. Antoine's wife Marianne won't talk to him, and his old friend Clive from French colonial days is mystified by his antisocial behavior. But his 10-year-old daughter Anna loves him. He explains things. For instance, and I quote, he wanted to tell her that we have all been measured in different ways for different lengths, that we are made of time, like grass or sundials or water. He wanted to make her think of the visible shapes of time, growth and passing and decay, rivers, insects, the clusters of lantana flowers whose stems she liked to suck, and even the slowly shifting constellations in a darkness that was also dying. A child will drown in the lake in Quebec. Earlier in Buenos Aires, another child drowned in a bucket of water in a police station. Earlier than that, there was a sea monster fished up dead on a dock in Algiers. At the end of the novel, Anna will also look up from the silence and darkness at the bottom of a sea, watched by phosphorus faces. But she is drowning in history instead of water. And for every image of drowning in news from a foreign country came, there's an image of burning, caterpillars with their tree webs set on fire, a madwoman and a holy man consumed to ash by their knowledge of God, a body in a fiery bed after the Latin Americans, seeking revenge, have come to Quebec with a bomb. Nor are these paired images the only correspondences in Alberto Manguel's haunting pages. As if in counterpoise, for the copperplate night, there is Our Lady of Africa, a peach-colored Madonna in the Algerian sunset. Competing with Brahms, there is screaming. When figures move with watery silence through white-tiled rooms, are we in a monastery or a torture chamber? News from a Foreign Country Came is a novel about terrorism, the best I've ever read, and I've read a lot of them, by heavyweights like Heinrich Böll and Mary McCarthy and John le Carré and Doris Lessing. Through three different minds, the father, the mother, and the child, in several different cities, Algiers, Paris, Buenos Aires, Alberto Manguel meditates on our bloody century and asks us to imagine a zealous guardian who would preserve the clear space, the necessary order, the last and perfect point, the still center of the culture, against chaos and destruction by resorting to torture. A moral bankrupt who rationalizes torture as a cleansing and thinks of himself as purified by his responsibility and aspiration. A cultured monster who will teach his system, so detached and meticulous, we are told, that it verges on boredom like the slow rotation of a planet, to other policemen everywhere. An expert in pain, for hire, who says to his students, "And all this time you must tell yourself, I am not part of this foreign country, this alien body, this other suffering. It is he, the patient, who has brought this on himself. No one ever drowns. People choose to stop living. Drowning is a suspension of the will." When 10-year-old Anna at last meets her father, she gives up hope and love itself.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. I'm taking a few days off. Frank Browning will be hosting the show while I'm gone. Welcome back, Frank. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In 1984, poet David Mura, a Japanese-American, knew more Yiddish than Japanese. Then he spent a year in the land of his grandparents and came back with a deeper sense of his heritage and what it's like not to be white in America. I'm Frank Browning, and I'll speak with David Mura on the next edition of Fresh Air.